so that we younger men and also the people listening or with the pamphlet will understand the character of the figures involved in the Austrian school.
Yes.
And my first question that I had was on Menger. What was his? He did not, as you say, he did not want to publish, and yet he had enormous impact of the ideas. What was the character of Menger as a teacher or a personality which made ideas carry forth even though he wrote so little?
Well, that's a question I've often asked myself. See, I hardly knew Menger. I've seen him a single time when he was about 80, long retired, marching in an academic profession. And the comic part of the story is when later I wrote a biographical essay on him, editing his works, there's one single sentence which is based on my own experience, and that is the only one which is wrong. Because he made a very impressive figure, so I described him as a tall man, and afterward everybody told me, "You are wrong, it's quite medium-sized." It was such an impressive figure. Having seen him, I described him as a tall man. Now, that his seminar, which ceased as early as 1903, when he retired, a small group of very intelligent people, and as was a Vienna tradition, associated his regular meetings with his former teacher and former students who were already occupying important positions in a coffee house created a Menger circle about the century, which had largely vanished. That was dominated the first third of last century. But since Menger retired in 1903, very little was left beginning of this century. Then during World War I, the most powerful personal figure among his students, Böhm Bamberg, also died. And so died the great textbook expositor, Filipowicz. And indeed, even the third man, who ultimately became my teacher, Friedrich von Wieser, had in one of the last governments of the Austro-Hungarian Empire been Minister of Trade, so a temporary university. So when I came back from the war in 1918, was not a single one of the great teachers teaching. In fact, economics was in charge temporarily, rather comically, of an economic historian who was a socialist and became later the founder of the famous Marxist-Freudian Frank Institute of Social Research. But Wieser came back.
Who was that? I don't
Grünberg remember. Is his name, Karl Grünberg. Later people in the Frankfurt Institute were the representative figures of Marx-Freud tradition of the 19th century. But he himself was an economic historian inclined in that direction, scholarly head for something which became a very political institution, but wholly uninteresting to us. And there was Wieser, who came back and became still my teacher. And Mises, who was what's called a prezent, an unpaid man who had the license to teach at the university, that to earn his living as a secretary of the Chamber of Commerce. Now, please be discreet about this point because it raises very touchy problems. But it is commonly believed, and Mises himself asserted it, that he was never given a position because of anti-Semitism. It's not as simple as this, because half the law faculty consisted of Jews. Well, the problem why Mises didn't get a professorship is a very peculiar one. And my answer to this, which I don't think has ever been stated, but which I will tell you is, order for a Jew to get a professorship, he had to have the support of his Jewish fellows. Any other Jews who were sufficiently eminent to be supported, because all the appointed Jews could get a professorship. But the Jews who were teaching were all socialists, and Mises was an anti-socialist. So he could not get the support of his own fellows. So the reason why he did not get a professorship was not really anti-Semitism, but he wasn't liked by his Jewish colleagues. It's a very comic story, and which I tell you this hesitation, because it's something you cannot prove. I'm quite certain it's correct from my knowledge of the position. But the Vienna of the 1920s and 1930s is not intelligent without the Jewish problem, which was not a problem simply of Christians and Jews, but a very large middle group in between the two, partly of baptized Jews, partly of Christians who had made friends with the Jews, and there was close contact between a purely Christian group, the mixed group, and again between the mixed group and the Jewish group, but not between the two events. And I became very much aware of this quite a recent time ago, and I was asked whom of the great figures of Vienna I had known at the time. Have you known, for instance, Schrödinger? Yes, of course. Wittgenstein? Yes, of course. And so on. Then he came to Freud. No, Freud, I couldn't possibly have known Freud. Why? Because he belonged to the Holy Jewish group, and that was beyond my reach of acquaintances. I had a great many very close acquaintances in the mixed group. I constantly moved in it. But to have met somebody in the purely Jewish group was so unlikely that being told that because I was a Viennese, I ought to have known Freud seemed to be absurd.
Was not Freud a private docent for many years himself? And was Freud also private docent?
Oh, yes.
When did he ever take a university position?
Never, you know. Both Mises and Freud had the title professor, but it was purely a title. They were Privatdozenten, had the license to teach, what the Privatdozent means, and were finally decorated for being called professor, but never received a penny from the university.
It's remarkable that two of the most important minds of Vienna were unable to teach.
Very large number. And not only people,
they taught, but they
in the majority
paid.
Of instances, they were Jewish. But not only Jews, people who had highly unpopular views, but were recognized in a way, would get a license to teach, but not a regular professorship.
Now, I have a question on this mixed group. Is this another religious group, or what do you mean a mixed group?
Mostly Christian Jews.
Christian.
And Jews and Christians who were not anti-Semites.
Oh, I see.
Who readily mixed with each other. And it was on the margin of the two pure groups, there was an intermediate group of people who very readily mixed and knew each other. I mean, the extreme Jew and the extreme Christian would hardly communicate with the other side.
You were a relative of Wittgenstein, are you not?
Yes, but Wittgenstein, I think, was a Jewish. It so happens that... Please, this is off the record.
Fine.
I will tell you this stuff. The first I heard of Wittgenstein was when I was a very small boy, and one of my aunts, of my stern, country ancestors, once remarked, "Grandfather has sold his daughter to a Jewish banker in Vienna." That was how the relation to the Wittgensteins ever came about.
I see. All right.
But they were completely established in Vienna society. As in general, you know, the Jewish problem in Vienna became acute only as a result of the recent emigration from Poland. There was an old established Jewish population in Vienna, partly of local origin, partly of Hungarian or Bohemian origin, were fully accepted and recognized. The violent anti-Semitism occurred when very primitive, poor Polish Jews immigrated already before the war and partly in flight from the Russians during the war. Vienna became filled with a type of Jew which hadn't been known before, in the captain, the long beard and all that, which we hadn't even seen before. And it was against them that the violent anti-Semitism arose.
And was that in the 20s?
Huh?
1920s or 30s? What period?
Still during
what
the,
period?
During the Great War, the
World War I.
It developed during the 30s. But the immigration occurred during the First Great War.
So you regarded yourself as this mixed group. You didn't...
My family is purely on the... was a purely Christian group, but in the university context, I entered into the mixed group.
Yeah.
Do you think, was Menger equally respected by all scholars of the period? Was he seen as a
Menger
profound, a penetrating mind?
Menger would be, and as I said, during the 1970s, the 1870s, during the end of the century, the division was not yet so sharp. Menger himself made himself, before he became a professor, a reputation as a journalist, which is was in Vienna a largely Jewish profession. So he was very much respected in the Jewish intellectual circle. Now, Menger's story, I ought not to anticipate too much, because I have now a great deal of information, what is still a confidential document. Menger's son, the mathematician, is producing a biography, which I have read in manuscript, but is not yet published. So I mustn't give away too much.
Well, can you tell us, can you show us on this map any highlights of Menger's life that we should note? Like you were saying, now he was, wasn't he the finance minister? Of,
No. He was only for many years tutor of the Archduke Rudolf, the son of Francis Joseph, who committed suicide in the end. And through that, he had intimate contacts. But apart from this, he refused every official position. In contrast to his successors, the Böhm Bawerk was for many years Minister of Finance, and Wieser in the end had to come in more as a figurehead at the very end of the old empire.
Mises believes that a suicide, he says in his notes and recollections, he believes it was the pessimism about the future which had been imparted to him from Menger, which led to the suicide, that it wasn't the relationship with the girl, but he despaired about the liberal future. Do you think that Mises is exaggerating that?
Yes, it certainly contributed greatly. I wouldn't dare to make as simple a statement of any one cause, but this was a very strong contributory factor. Rudolf the Crown Prince had been made by Mengele a 19th century liberal, very much in conflict with the Austro then ruling tradition. His attempts to reform it proved unsuccessful. The chance of his father living on forever, as it turned out to be true, that he had no prospect within the foreseeable future to do anything about it, was quite enough to put him in a state of very deep depression. I believe the immediate cause was probably something quite different, but that his basic depressive view of the world, which made him ready for suicide, was due to his seeing the world in the light of an 19th century liberal, which Menger had made him. Menger's influence on him was evidently, as I gather now from the biography of his son, very much greater than I had imagined. Mises, who couldn't have known this except by stories, is evidently right.
The influence of the seminar was very great. Menger's, von Bewerk's, and the meetings that Mises had in the 20s.
It's different.
What were the differences?
The Menger seminar did not produce mainly academics. From the Menger seminar emerged quite a number. Menger started too late to have his immediate successors when Babek and Mises as his students. Mises and Ben Babek had just completed their studies when Menger, and were already out of the university by the time he started teaching.
Now stop. I'm confused on the chrono. I'm confused here. Which book are we speaking of?
The Grundsätze.
And that was published in the
71.
All right. Now that was the beginning of his published. Now I'm getting it. Of the published career, Mises was. Didn't he get his degree about 1906?
Oh, yes.
Or thereabouts?
And Mises was already post-Mengerian.
All right.
Mises was never a direct pupil of Menger.
And Wieser and
von
Bewerk came on the faculty, or were they both students in that seminar with Menger? They were not.
They had already graduated.
All right, I see.
And gone as graduate students to Germany before Menger was appointed.
All right.
Menger assisted them because he found in them the first people who believed in his book. But they were no longer students at that time.
All right.
And from the mid-70s, when Menger began to teach, to 1903, when he retired, his seminar produced a substantial number of distinguished high civil servants and statesmen. It had a as a seminar, and through his coffee house round, a considerable influence on the upper intellectual level of Vienna.
And you say that coffee house is gone now? Do we know where it was?
No, I'm not sure. I believe I know. Do you all know Vienna at all or not yet?
Not really. I brought this map of the central part of Munich. Will that help?
Well, the main...
Because here's the university, I think.
If this is the university, this block of houses has at both ends coffee houses. This is a more popular one. This is the one specially favored by the economists. But it was quite regular that, for instance, professors would meet their students after the lecture. In the coffee house. I'm not sure which coffee house Menger frequented. In this century, It was this one, which no longer exists.
Which one? This
try,
one?
Try to get the two names. This is called Landmann. This was called the Kunstwerk of Faith, the artist's copy. The land exists. It's the older history. Used to be the general resort. The Kunstwerk of Faith, on the other side, became specialized to the economists, in particular to some of them who had the habit of practically spending their life in the coffee house.
Do we need to get the spelling of those?
Yes, perhaps we should get the spelling so that we...
Let's get the spelling of both of those.
Did students meet with the senior professor over coffee?
Well, the professors would have... one typical instance I knew very well. We have an early morning lecture. We would take coffee there, and the students would come if they wanted to consult the professor. For the students, the coffee was very moderate. See, to luxurious a place to go to. While the Vienna coffee house, of course, where in fact you could spend a day paying for a cup of coffee, was very attractive for intellectuals, but of a slightly higher level than the actual student. The student got the thing even still cheaper in the university. But the professor, who after his lecture retired to his cup of coffee, would receive professors. I suspect, but I do not know, that like many slightly older, younger men I knew, many also would have met his people at the Café Landmann. But in Menger's case, the main importance was that not students, but ex-students met regularly in a kind of circle discussing current politics. While Menger never became active in current Austrian politics, as an influence and the intellectual heart of 19th century liberalism became very, very important. And even high civil servants who would have been his students in the 1870s would sit in 19th or the beginning of the century, still regularly come once a week for a conversation with Menger. That became the heart of what it's so difficult today. You can't talk to Americans about liberalism without the understanding what it means.
Well, we'll footnote your article to it where you explain it, and that will be enough. So we know what we mean, so you go ahead.
if you have to explain it, you might almost say that in 19th century continental Europe, liberalism meant in America conservatism means today. That is roughly the right definition. And in this sense, in opposition against the advanced interventionism and in socialism of the government, the Menger group remained a Gladstonian liberal group in Europe of great importance. And he remained the inspirer of all sorts of, no point I couldn't from memory to mention the people in high public positions to whom Menger was the oracle, the wise man available.
Did those men at a later date achieve important positions or influence to either turn the thinking of the public or at least of the other ministers away from the interventionism? Or did they, if they did, when did their influence end? Was it during the war?
When they died.
Well, all right.
When they retired.
All right. And when was that? In the 30s, the 20s?
In the second and third century of this, decade of this century. I will say the first and the second, very little left when Austria collapsed. People were still about, but they were retired and it lost influence.
What about von Bewerk's seminars? Let's talk about those.
Well, that is quite different here. This was the center of the academic development. That was a place where the great, the Bamberg and Wieser, as you will read, were wholly different characters. It's very curious. They were exact companions, school fellows, university colleagues, brothers in law, working on the same subject, going together to German university, but of a wholly different scientific attitude. I've once written an essay under the title Two Types of Mind, which is partly modeled on this Bamberg's absolute master of his subject.
Yes.
He knew the answer to everything at once. Anything which had been said before, he knew.
Yes.
A clear conception of it all.
And Wieser was the puzzler.
With a tendency to simplify, not to avoid real difficulties.
Yes.
Wieser, a slow, thoughtful person, doing nothing was simple, was all frightfully difficult. Who hated discussing anything, because he had to give a quick answer. He wanted to think about everything else. So much so, to take an episode, which is rather amusing. Sometime before World War I, for a while, the English economist Alfred Marshall and Wieser happened to go for summer holidays to the same place in the South Tyrol, the Dolomites, and nodded to each other year after year, polite, but never had any wish to discuss economics. Then Bamberg came on a visit, brought them together, insisted that they discuss economics. They all reported that a very exciting day, but neither Wieser nor Marshall ever went to the same place again.
Where was this?
In St. Grödner Valley in the Dolomites.
Was Wieser more like Frank Knight in the way he went about things?
Oh, yes. I have, in fact, in that essay which I mentioned about two types of mind, in a footnote given Wieser and Frank Knight as a similar pair.
Yes.
To me.
We hear very little of his students. We hear more of von Bewerk's students. Is there a reason for that?
Oh, yes. In the seminars, there are wholly different affairs. Bamberg's seminars were highly exciting. He had, apart from the main original thinkers of his own school, a good many of the socialists of the time, people like Otto Bauer and forget all the names, with violent discussions going on. What was discussed in Bamberg's seminar was discussed all over the university. Wieser's seminar would be quietly on one neat problem, carefully prepared paper, which then picked to pieces, but very far away from any topical issue of any kind. The Bamberg seminar ended before World War I. He died in 1914 or 15. I have only known the Wieser seminar. It was interesting from a purely theoretical point of view, but nobody could be really excited about it.
Were you in both? Did you have...
Of course, when Bamberg died, I was 16.
Ah, that's right. All right.
I knew Bamberg only by chance, because he happened to be a friend of my grandfather, my maternal grandfather, and he were at the same time professors at Innsbruck in the 1980s. And Actually, it may also amuse you. Used to climb mountains together here in the Tiger Mountains, and even did, which was still possible in the 1880s, do some first ascents together to some of the peaks and mountains we explored. And before my grandfather died, maternal grandfather, I repeat, in 1910, I used to meet Ben Babak in his house. Before I knew what the word economics meant, he was just a close friend of my parents and grandparents. But he died in 1915. So even when he died, I was 16. I used later to meet his widow still, who had been a maternal friend of my mother. My mother called his widow aunt, because in the years here together in Salzburg.
Who do you regard as the most important of the graduates of Boehm-Bawerk Seminar? Mises, of course, would be one famous graduate. Schumpeter was one. I believe Karl Pribram was one.
Yes.
Were there any other?
Karl Pribram was not really a theoretician at all.
I understand that, but he was an important
writer. Well, I'm not sure whether Mises' main successor, Hans Meyer, he may or may not have been. And then there were a few other quite influential economists who were not strictly Austrians, particularly a man called Alfred Ammon. But then, as I said, his various later socialist leaders, Otto Bauer, who became one of the leaders of the Austrian Marxists, Ilferding, who later played a great role in Germany, Emil Lederer, who, when the Germans in the 1920s had to appoint a new professor in Berlin, the one who took a socialist but had to take it from the Austrian school, and so took this rather insignificant Lederer, which was a cause by Schumpeter America. He had counted on the chair in Berlin and didn't get it. When he didn't get it, he went off to Harvard. Now that is roughly the ground. On this point, the exact content of Boehm-Bawerk's seminar, my former assistant, Leube, who is now in Stanford, seems to have got some information. It's the only point on which I have no... It's very curious, see, among the generation just above me, the experience of the Boehm-Bawerk seminar was the great experience of their youth, would all the time talk about, but there are no details. The atmosphere, as if it were familiar to me, but when, as you now ask me, give me some information. I know no facts. I know what names were occasionally mentioned. And
do you know?
It certainly, in the Vienna of the 1920s, the reference, we discussed this in the Boehm-Bawerk seminar before the war, was a constant event. This was a great experience of the generation just before me, who would constantly remember, how interesting when we are all discussing this together.
Now, were these seminars always held at the university?
These were all happening in the university. And brings back to this. In the first floor of the West Wing, the left wing, let's call it, if you look at it from the Ringstrasse,
yes,
first floor of this was the center of law and economics.
And is that still where...
That's still where it is,
okay.
Yes. The only other center, which for the later period, is the offices of Mises, and incidentally myself and Haberlin, which is in the Chamber of Commerce of Vienna. Still he left in 1934 to all his living from being one of the secretaries of the Chamber of Commerce. He became there the source of two appointments in the same building, not in the same office. Or well, in the same office in certain case, yes. He got harbor letters as librarian of the Chamber of Commerce. Well, so long Harbour remained in Yan, he worked in the same building. My story is a little more complicated. When I had graduated in 1921, arose in Vienna a new temporary office to carry out certain conditions of the peace treaty of 1918. The settlement of pre-war private debts between the nations. Mises, on behalf of the Chamber of Commerce, was one of the directors of this new office. It was very attractive to new people, because every young man who had studied law and spoke two foreign languages could get a much better position in the other circumstances. I was one of these fortunate men and came, but that again, this is off the record, but for your amusement, came to Mises with a letter of introduction from Mises recommending me for this position. And Mises, I still can see him before me, reading Mises' lecture, letter of introduction, looking at me. Mises says, "You're a promising young economist. I've never seen you at my lectures." Still, he gave me the job. And so for the next 5 years, interrupted by a visit to America, was working under him. And then when I brought back from America the new idea of trade predictions, the sort of thing which the Harvard Economic Barometer then had developed in the early 20s, Mises helped me to create in the same building an institute for business cycle research.
About what year?
That was the second part of the 20s. The first part of the 20s I worked with him in that office. And from 27 to 31, exactly, till I went to London, I was acting as an organizer of this institute, beginning as myself and the secretary, and gradually expanding it, getting in Morgenstern as my collaborator, who afterwards took over from me.
Now, can you locate the Chamber of Commerce?
I will in a moment.
Okay.
The Chamber of Commerce building then became so important, because during the 1920s until he left Vienna in 1940, when I had already been gone, Mises' office was the place of a so-called private seminar that took place at the Chamber of Commerce during the academic year twice a month. Now, just in Vienna, which are interest, while the coffee houses, both of them, you may use the one which has survived as representative for the other which has not.
Now, what this is significant, though. Now, you are saying that Mises teaching outside of the university,
the advanced
for advanced teaching, students did not get credit for this.
Nothing at all. It was a purely discussion club.
Who are some of the people who came that you remember or ever heard of that would be important for us?
Well, first of an intermediate generation between Mizraim, people who were still in the Bembaberg seminar, a man called Strigel, whom we all expected to succeed to the professorship, but who died young, and another man whose collected essays will appear shortly, called Shams, S-C-H-A-M-S. Then comes my nation, which I am slightly the oldest, although I have one contemporary, and one who might be able to interview, a lady called Steffi Brown, who lives in New York.
How would that be spelled? Do you know?
Well, she now spells it English, B-R-O-W-N. She used to be B-R-A-U-N when I knew her,
Stephanie,
in Austria. I have got a address book upstairs. I might give you one or two of the addresses later. She, I believe, is the only surviving member of my own age. There used to be another woman of the same age, was secretary of the bank association, the name of Lisa, L-I-E-S-E-R, Lena Lisa, although been dead for many years. Then comes Haberlow, only a year my junior. Then, to take first the better-known figures, Machlup, who is another 2 years younger, Morgenstern, who was at Princeton, well, you might say it was a group of some, a total of up to 20 people, of whom about 12 would regularly meet twice a month in Mises' actual Chamber of Commerce office without any formal connection with the university, all ex-university students, discussing, I believe, predominantly questions of scientific methodology rather than particular problems, even if we start out with a very practical, concrete problem of the time, would very soon be off with the conflict between the different schools of economics. Later, in the early 1930s, means the last 4 years, when it still met, it became a considerable point of attraction for foreign students. That was after I had left. I don't remember, but I know that during the later years, English-American students used to come in for a term, take part in these discussions. And during these final years of the Austrian school in Austria, it was the center, not only for the Austrian school itself, which attracted students from all over the world to join into the discussion. That I knew mainly by hearsay, because I was the first to leave Vienna before emigration in any sense had yet started. Because I never imagined that I was emigrating. But if at the age of 32 you're offered a professorship at the University of London, you take it. I never considered that this was moving myself outside Austria. It was just the first decisive step in my academic career. It was the world which prevented me from ever returning after this.
Now let me ask you a a question that may embarrass you, but it must be asked. If Mises had was attracting English-speaking students in the early 30s, or perhaps even some in the late 20s, yet Mises is known in the English-speaking world in the 30s only because of you, really. This isn't production.
It's not as simple as this.
Well, for those of us who remember it, that's how, so maybe you can clarify.
The decisive person was Lionel Robbins, the later Lord Robbins, at the London School of Economics.
The question is simply, we know of Robbins' early work today in retrospect because of the nature and significance, which I think was 32.
No, I believe it was 30 already.
Perhaps you're right. But that is, we don't think of that as being a book promoting Mises or the Austrians. So there must be some other influence you have in mind there that was more important than your, because prices and production.
You know, by that time, 31, Mises was still a relatively minor figure, confined to a particular field. But the man who had done two things, a theory of money and the system of socialism. His great book, his philosophical essay, came out even in German only in 1938, and the American version only in the 1940s. That established him as a great social philosopher. But by the early 1930s, Mises was internationally, so far as he was known at all, which is limited, but known to people like Robbins and a man who had done a distinctive contribution to the theory of money, developing Menger, and developing most effectively his criticism of socialism.
But for those of us who are young or starting out, and we look at a man's career, who in his 30s, I gather, wrote Theory of Money and Credit, which in retrospect seems to be a masterpiece, yes. I mean a path-breaking book, and then the Theory of Socialism, which influenced you and Robbins and Röpke and I don't know how many others, but a lot of very bright young men of his era, and turned them from socialism. How is it in 1931, which is 19 years after Money and Credit, and 9 years after socialism, why is it that he was still unknown in the profession?
None of his books were cited.
That's a good reason.
See, it was Robbins and I who were arranged in London for the translation.
But what I want to know is, why, now you were invited to be a professor at the London School, or is it the London School of Economics? Or
yes.
But why wasn't Mises invited? Couldn't speak
English?
Well,
see, I had done a thing which none of us had done. I had, before the beginning of Rockefeller Fellowships, in 1923, on my own risk, gone to America, spent 15 months in America, and was, in consequence, speaking fluent English. That's number one. It's not the whole story. That was a precondition. Mises could hardly have done this at the time. Not my other colleagues. But two, I had, while in America, devoted a lot of time to the criticism of a peculiar kind of American underconsumption analysis, which was very similar what Keynes later produced, as of Foster and Catchings. I don't know if you still remember these names. I spent a great and was absolutely ready to criticize any underconsumption theory which then Keynes produced. And I pounced upon him, completely equipped to deal with this.
This would have been about what year?
What?
What year that you began to interact with Keynes?
Well, I had begun by still in the States in 24, But I was working all the time on these sort of problems, was preparing, and that's the third of four elements which I have to mention. I had started writing a great treatise on money, which I never completed, but for which I proposed to start these 10 chapters on the history of monetary theory and policy, of which by the end of the 20s I had written the first four chapters dealing with the development in England between 1690 and 1900. So when I came to London, and I will explain this in a moment, I proved to know much more about the history of English monetary theory than any of the English professors, which caused a great impression. And the fourth unheard lucky subject is that when I gave in Vienna my initial lecture as a private docent, I chose for my subject this kind of consumption theory which had just become acute in England, and Robbins could read German. That's a very almost unique factor, an English professor who could read German literature. That's a good luck that he pounced on my subject. This is the things we need at the moment to fight Keynes. So I was brought in for this purpose, produced a course of lectures which was original, which suggested more knowledge of the history of English theory than anybody else. Was sympathetic by Robbins, who had been influenced by the Austrian school. We at once understood each other. This combination of accidents to my appointment in London. I mean, it was luck from beginning to end.
But it was prices and production which brought the Austrian trade cycle theory to the attention of our world.
I would to say a fifth point, equally accidental, the invitation reached me when I had for the first time a clear picture of this theory, but had not yet gone into all the complicated details. As I have started working it out in an elaborate treatise, I would have encountered any number of complications, would have produced a very difficult treatise. The invitation met me at the moment when I could just quickly tell the story as a general survey as I then saw it, without yet being up here. Then, to give you the main illustration, which later held up the development, for my simple exposition, I could operate with a grave simplification in Böhm Bawerk, operating with an average period of production. Now, the average period of production is a beautiful simplification, but doesn't help you at all. A general exposition I could give as soon as I became aware it's not a question of a single average period of production, but a neatly complex structure. I would have got all, if I had been aware of this in 1931, I could not have given a beautiful, simple exposition, but would have confused everybody. But I was myself yet aware of the difficulties. So I gave this incredibly successful lectures, but it was not really the merit. It was a situation in which this particular set of lectures hit in London. I mean, I expected nothing less than that four lectures I give in London would lead to an invitation. And of course, in the first instance, it produced only an invitation for a visiting professorship for 1 year. But I fitted in so well, and now Robbins and I became very close friends. We worked beautiful together, and from 31 till 40, we were really thinking together and working together.
Was the
London? Then I'm afraid Lowell fell under Keynes' influence.
Well, that happened to a number of your contemporaries. But let me ask you this. The London School was originally a Fabian institution. How was it that by 1931 you and Robbins were both on the faculty?
That's a person, I hold it to the person of Edwin Cannon. The Webbs, in a sense, very decent. They wanted a good theoretician who was an independent mind, and were so convinced that unprejudiced study of economics must lead to socialism, made the mistake of somebody who wouldn't at all. And he, who was the main professor, and Foxwell, who had the professorship of money banking, were completely separated from the Fabian part. And all through my years, I mean, although in a way Lasky and I had something in common, we were both great book collectors, but apart from this, we had of course nothing in common at all. We hardly spoke the same language. Don't ask me to begin to tell stories about LSC. It was extremely, because of this comic place, and the extraordinary person of Harold Lasky, was a most peculiar place.
Give us a couple of stories. We need at least one or two.
Harold Lasky was a pathological problem. Means even among his friends today recognized that he was a pathological liar who just couldn't. Well, if you have time, we'll tell you one or two stories, which everybody will. First, from our book collecting experience. You know, book collectors are like fishermen. They always have found something unique. But Harold Lasky took the following poems. Would come one midday when we always met after lunch in the senior common room, enthusiastic, just been to a chair in Crossroad, and in one of these boxes there were some beautiful French duodecimo volumes of the 18th century that turned them over, all the religious stuff. Suddenly found that the back of one was thicker than the other. So I asked the man, how much is it? Sixpence each. So put down a shilling, took the two volumes, slit it open, and out fell four letters exchanged between Rousseau and Voltaire. They were never published. It was typical for the man.
He just made the story up?
Completely.
Amazing.
All the... later, in... Well, there are two memorable occasions in the same room. Even before we moved to Cambridge in 39, in preparation of a probable outbreak of war, as in 1940, before we had all moved by bombing in London started, both Lasky and I were spending evenings of the days we were teaching. We were still coming up from London for 2 days a week, in the house of one colleague, Lancelot Beales. Now, the first occasion was only very remarkable because Harold Lasky was lecturing to us about the beauties of the Russian system, and was interrupted by the announcement of the news. We were all listening. The BBC, I believe, at 7:30. The news came through of the Stalin-Ribbentrop Pact. And afterwards, Lasky behaved as he had never in his life said a good word. Bolsheviks, the most abominable creature for him. And a change in the man, he didn't seem to have remembered what he had been done for the past preceding 20 years of his life. But a year later, in exactly the same position, again sitting together after dinner, listening to the news, Harold had just been to his home Manchester and had his bombing attack. And on that occasion, had been very shaken because one bomb had fallen close to his hotel had badly shaken him. Within 3 weeks, I felt every stage of this story had become a story that his hotel had been hit and he had put his bed to 4 floors into the cellar.
The London school, was it mostly peopled, students, in terms of students, were they Fabians? Were they just students trying to get a degree? What was the motivation to come to the London school in the third?
Well, you have to distinguish between the faculty and students. Faculty was this enormous difference between economists on the one hand and political scientists and sociologists on the other. In between, there were the lawyers, the geographers, the economic historians, who were either neutral or the usual type would be a very mild Fabian. People of the Bloomsbury group, people like Eileen Power, who stuck in the Bloomsbury group, very nice and decent people, and they are very not doctrinaire.
I had no idea she was in any way connected with what Eileen Power was connected with Bloomsbury?
Oh, yes.
I didn't know
she
that.
She happened to live there. The Bloomsbury people were neighbors. She knew them all.
All right, okay.
In this sense, I don't think she was any active, but they were all very familiar to her.
All right, go ahead.
And Tawney was, of course, also a Fabian, but a man with whom you could talk, not a doctor now. A very interesting man. Personally, I liked Tawney. Harold Darsky was always a joke, and I could never take Harold Darsky. But at that time, people took him still seriously. Now, even his party fellows, even before his death, take him seriously as a thinker. He must have been, as a very young man, very brilliant. But by the time I knew him, he was not.
Bring up something you have mentioned in a couple of places in your writings. It is significant, but I want to ask a further question. You write of the time that you spent preparing a review of Keynes's treatise on money. And then once it was published, Keynes had said to you, oh, well, I've changed my view. So then when the general theory came out, you decided at that time that it would be unwise to spend the same amount of time to critique the book only to have him do the same thing over. Now, those of us who live on the far side of general theory suspect that had you published, it might have been different. I am of the opinion that it would not have been different, that the times were just moving in the direction of Keynes. In retrospect, what do you think?
You know, it's a much more complicated story. I've myself put it in the way in which you were quoted. But by being disillusioned by Keynes so easily take, oh, it no longer matters, I've had a later experience with him of the same sort, which we tell you later, but a much more complicated position. I by then had become very much aware that in that simplified form, based on the Bimbavik's, as I mentioned before, average field of production, my theory could not really be carried through. So I'd come to the conclusion and must first build up an adequate theory of capital for a return to industrial fluctuations. That took me 7 years to do so, but even then I only published the first static volume, assuming I would go over to the dynamic part. But then a very curious position arose. But then war had broken out, and Keynes was almost the only sensible man who was willing and protectors and able to protect us against inflation. So during the war years, I was supporting Keynes against his supporters as the one man who actually did succeed in getting into the war without inflation. So during the war, on practical politics, I was on Keynes' side. and didn't want to discredit him. An attack on Keynes during the war years would have been what I believed was right. I was grateful for his existence. And that I was in a great measure right proves my last experience with Keynes, a story I've told many times, but I do not mind repeating. A few weeks before his death, that means it must have been in the about January 1946, I was still treated as an honorary fellow of King's College, as he had lived through the war in Cambridge. Keynes had given me rooms in his college. And after I had returned to Cambridge, I still came occasionally to King's to dine there. And on the very large occasion, when two things occurred, which I usually tell as illustration of the respect in which Keynes was a genius. Then in the end, we happened to sit together in the smoking room of the college, reading the daily newspapers. At a stage, I asked him, "Tell me, aren't you getting alarmed by what Joan Robinson and Richard Carnahan are making of your theories? Danger are clearly inflation." And he burst out, "Oh, they are just fools. You know, my theories are important in the deflation period of the 1930s. But trust me, if my theories ever become dangerous, I'm going to turn public opinion out." 6 weeks he was later and couldn't do it.
And that's a significant story. But in retrospect, after the pure theory of capital, you never went back. I mean, the Road to Serfdom came out. It was an extraordinary success.
Political,
philosophical book. And it seemed that that turned your interest to a wholly new field.
Perfectly true. I became much more interested in fact, in a way, as Mises had been, but not following Mises, in the differences of the philosophical approach of the social sciences, which led to different conclusions. I mean, it became particularly acute because Keynes, against his intentions, had stimulated the development of macroeconomics. I was convinced that not only his particular conclusions, but the whole foundation of macroeconomics was wrong. And so I wanted to demonstrate that we had to return to macroeconomics, that this whole prejudice supported by the natural scientists, they could deduce anything from measurable magnitudes, the effects of aggregates and averages, became to fascinate me much more. I felt in a way that the thing which I am now prepared to do, I don't know if there's anybody else who can do this particular task. I rather hoped that what I did in capital theory does would be continued by others. This was a new opening, which was much more fascinating. The other would have meant working for a result which I already knew, but I had to prove it, which was very dull. The other thing was an open problem. How does economics really look like when you recognize it as a prototype of a new kind of science of complex phenomena, which could not employ the simple model of mechanics or physics, but had to deal with what then I described as mere pattern predictions, certain limited predictions. That was so much more fascinating as an intellectual problem.
And yet capital theory, in the Austrian sense, ended with pure theory of capital, wouldn't you say, in retrospect?
I've read very largely. Nobody has done what I hoped to done better.
I mean, that's almost 50 years. It's 45 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And there's been nothing. In fact, I'll be quite honest, that's the one book of yours that gives me the most trouble.
How much this is true, I became very much aware about only 4 years ago. And I asked for permission to give a lecture on the same day, January 1981, exactly 50 years after my Prices of Production lectures, under the chairmanship of Lyle Robbins, under the title, In Goods and Services, this whole question of the variation of the time stream leading up to a public. And published only in a German translation, because supposed to be a chapter of the English work. But I became very much aware of what you say, that I, in effect, we are still where we were 50 years ago. The crucial point has not yet come. Well, it would be unfair to say sufficiently accepted. It has not yet been presented in a form that is fully satisfactory, even to me.
I have a question. There is a PhD thesis that was done at New York University looking at the series, the historical evidence in the United States to support the Hayekian theory of the business cycle. Have you seen that?
Which one is it? I've seen a cut number.
Well,
that kind of thing.
Robertson or something.
Not old this show.
No. This is much more recent.
This was like 1982. And
I probably only a little seen it from the outside.
Well,
there's now such a flood of books by Hayekians that I can no longer master.
To what do you attribute the late reaction? Now you're the dean of the school by dint of biology. You know, you've survived. There is this wave of interest now.
Well, he got
the Nobel Prize
in 1974. That rekindled
interest. No, the Nobel Prize had very little effect from 1974 till about 1980. Oh, yes, the external effects and so on. But I could not yet feel that it has stirred the interest of the younger generation. And for the past 5 years, been such a flood, I can no longer follow it. I mean, I don't think I'm exaggerating, get every month a new book dealing with my problems, and I'm concerned with my own task. I can't even read them.
Oh. Do you have any explanation? Here is my guess, but it is only a guess, that at last the question of the Keynesian aggregates is now being taken seriously, and you wound up as the man who 50 years ago first challenged it.
Yes, in a way, even simple. This is a disappointment with Keynes, which has turned into respect to me. In the mere fact of unemployment combined with inflation at the same time. Suddenly, disillusioned people.
And that's 79 and 80. That late 70s period. Now, let me ask a personal question. 10 years ago, now I'm going again by a 10-year memory, but I think I've got it close. 10 years ago, and I think it was in February, Reason Magazine, published an interview with you. And you made approximately the following statement. Fortunately, the worst prediction of your life. You talked about what you thought would come, which was unemployment, inflationary crisis, price controls, the command economy. And you said, we will see it within 10 years, but I will not see it, and I am thankful that I won't. Now, one, you're still here, and second, at least with respect to price controls and the command economy, we did not see it.
No, it's never become a spade of that.
Why do you...
Well, I believe the answer is in the United States, that there was then already underway a stream of young men, people knew, whom I began to discover very soon after that. But second thing is, I must also admit, that was done in a period when I was either still in or only recovering from a period which in a sense might be called depression, although the medical diagnosis that I was suffering from depression was pure nonsense. It's now been cleared up that I had about 69 and a little earlier, two heart attacks which knocked me out, one for 1 year and one for 5 years. I was unable to work from 69 to early 74, and not being able to work made me frightfully depressed and pessimistic. I've not been cured, as some of my friends maliciously suggest, by the Nobel Prize. I had already started publishing again early in the summer of 74 before I had any idea. But that before 74, I was for almost 5 years out of action intellectually, or at least unable to do any original work. I did such things as, for instance, that survey of the history of liberalism for an Italian encyclopedia, which has since been published in English translation, which not only just reproduces my old knowledge, but even makes some awful blunders of pure memory. If you know my writing at all, you'll see how absurd it is to write an intellectual history of liberalism and to forget to even mention Lord Acton, who was one of my great figures. But that thing could happen to me at that time, mm-hmm. when I was merely reviving things I knew with the act of thinking it. Sometimes I feel these 5 years have been a period of rest.
I want to go back now to some questions about the students of Mises. You maintained your commitment to the Austrian perspective generally, however you may have disagreed on some points with Mises, but you're still an Austrian economist.
Schumpeter, no.
Schumpeter, of course, was a friend of Mises, or if not a friend, at least a colleague, an intellectual peer. Haberler abandoned his open commitment.
Haberler has never been greatly interested in the philosophical basis of it.
What about Maklub? We don't think of him as an Austrian today, though he was.
How about Alvin Haynes?
He was and he was not. He knew it all, but he was not basically a philosophical thinker.
Was it Keynes's work, or was it the reaction regarding the length of the Depression? Robbins is a case in point. You cannot get him to discuss the Great Depression. That book has fallen into Robbins' memory hole. It's not there anymore. Was it a disillusionment about the theory as a result of either Keynes or the Depression that you think may have... Well, Alvin Hansen is another. Alvin Hansen became the teacher of Samuelson, of all things.
And he was one of your students, right?
No, he was my contemporary in age.
But he was influenced by your thinking.
Yeah.
He was at one stage influenced me. But Hansen, I'm afraid I don't take him seriously. Really. He was a man quick to learn. He was not a real theoretical thing. But let me get to the crucial point. What I see only now clearly It's a problem of my relation to Mises, which began with my 1937 article on economics and knowledge, which was an attempt to persuade Mises himself that when he asserted that the market theory was a priori, he was wrong. That what was a priori was only the logic of individual action, but the moment you passed from this to the interaction of many people, you entered into the empirical field. Curiously enough, while Mises was very resentful of any criticism by his pupils and temporarily broke.
Go ahead.
Temporarily broke both with Mahmoud and Haberlin because they had criticized the thing. He took my critique silently and even approved the article as if he had not been aware that it was a criticism of his own views. I cannot explain this. But my view has gone very much further. My reason. I believe I can now even explain why what I admit is a masterly socialism has not been really effective. Because Mises remained in the end himself a rationalist utilitarian. And with a rationalist utilitarianism, a rejection of socialism is irreconcilable. Socialism, the capitalism, presumes that apart from our rational insight, we possess a traditional endowment of morals, which has been tested by evolution, but not designed by our intelligence. We have never invented private property because we understood its consequences, nor have we ever invented the family. It so happened that those traditions, essentially religious tradition, and I am as much an Archimedes as Mises was, but I must admit that the two decisive traditions which made it possible for us to build up an order which extends our vision cannot be the result of our intellectual insight, but must be the result of a moral tradition which, as I now put it, is the result of group selection and not of individual selection. Something which we can expost, interpret, but Mises postulate, if we are strictly rational and decide also we can see that socialism is wrong, it's like if we remain strict rationalist utilitarians, that implies we can arrange everything according to our pleasure. So Mises never could free himself from that fundamental philosophy in which we have all grown up, all of our mission, that reason can do everything better than mere habit. From this he could never lose himself. In this respect, although I accept nearly everything of his criticism of socialism, I now understand why it has not been fully effective. Because in his case, it's still based on the fundamental mistake of rationalism and socialism, that we have the intellectual power to arrange everything rationally, which is an outright conflict with his assertion. In one place he says we can't do it, in another place he argues, being rational people, we must try to do it.
That's a significant difference.
Let me ask you, what was the basis? I mean, at seminars, was there a discussion of moral philosophy, of religion? What was the basis of the agnosticism in, I think, you know, among...
It was common among us to begin with.
Oh, it was.
You see, in a way, Vienna is the origin of so many schools of its own, which were dominant in the 1920s. And one of the fundamental and influential, which we all were partly caught, was logical positivism. In fact, Mises' brother, of course, Richard von Mises, one of the leading figures. He and I all grew up in this Ernst Mach philosophy that ultimately everything must be rationally justified. Till we both discovered that apart from our capacity of rationally organizing things, we rely also on something which we have never rationally invented, certain moral tradition. Let me tell you an amusing episode. It takes a little introduction. Even the Catholic Church has become very sensible, at least some members in it. And a very great man, the present Cardinal of Vienna, acts for the Vatican as a liaison between church and science. And in this effort, he had about 2 years ago organized a very remarkable event to be organized by cardinals of the Roman Catholic Church, a meeting on evolution on the 100th anniversary of the death of Charles Darwin. Imagine, organized by the Roman Catholic Church. On this occasion, I was asked to give a lecture on cultural evolution. It's distinct from biological evolution. With the cardinal, the chair before me, I made the rather rude remark as conclusion. I'm afraid even we agnostics must admit that we owe our civilization to superstitions. Of the cardinal made first a bitter face, and I apologized. No, it's too hard a word. Let's call it on symbolic truth, which has suddenly embraced me, and on the term symbolic truth, which are not rationally justifiable, which have prevailed, proved themselves in tradition, we're suddenly in complete agreement. He agreed. Of course, the truths of the religion are different from the truths of science. If you admit that civilization depends on symbolic truths, as you I call it, which are essential for the preservation of human civilization, there's no conflict between us anymore.
Now, in the 20s, that was not perceived. This is a later Hayek speaking.
This is what I'm now thinking.
Than the Hayek of the 1920s.
This is the fatal conceit on which I'm working. The whole idea, which is basic, that part of our order of cooperation is based not on deliberate designs which we understand, but on traditions which have prevailed because they have enabled more people to live than other traditions. A sort of quasi-Darwinian solution, which however differs from biological Darwinism, and not being based on selection of individuals, because the individuals can never perceive these effects. They are beyond their range of vision. They only show themselves in the active success of the group. Using for this purpose now the conception of an extended order operation. By extended, I mean an order which transcends our vision. Just the simple fact that we are all working for people whom we do not know and being supplied by people whom we do not know. We live in an order which is, in this sense, not perceivable to us. We produce through habits whose significance we do not understand, an order which has become essential for our survival in present numbers. This is the main theme of the book I'm preparing. and which, because it leads in so many philosophical problems, has taken me much longer to problem. The book has been in draft for at least 4 years. That's the first. We call it the fatal conceit. The fatal conceit meaning that the whole civilization is a creation of the human reason, that we have created it in knowing what we are doing. That I'm denying. And the crucial part is the three volumes of the fatal conceit of morals, economics, and politics. And the moral part, which has led me into the problems I've just been explaining, which have delayed the book so much. I had hoped to send the first volume to the printers before this summer. I'm still hanged with a very amusing chapter. The one chapter I have to rewrite now begins with the problem. Why has it been true for the last 100 years that the intelligent a person was, the more likely it was that he would be a socialist? Which is roughly true. I don't think you can deny it. Among the natural...
But not now.
It's improved. Among the physicists, it's almost still true. The biologists saw... Man, Einstein was an out and out. Einstein is one of my principal models.
I understand, but I believe in the last years it has begun to shift, and you're partially responsible.
But I still start with a paradigm, which is a Nobel Prize lecture by Jacques Monod, the French biologist, which explicitly said, science has now definitely proved to us it's nonsense to believe anything except what is empirically demonstrable. Going out at large, said all traditional morals are nonsense, we must build society on the morals which we invent. This I take to my
That's destructive.
But that's bad biology. It's not even good epistemology anymore.
In biology it's already bad, but in there are very few physicists, even at present.
Now, let's go back to Austria, the Austrian school, yeah, and Vienna. I know only a little about Vienna from the turn of the century through the 20s, as illiterate Americans pick up bits and pieces. Skorsky's book is about all I really know about, at best. Now, Vienna was almost a capital of intellectual ferment, from what I can see, from, say, 1880 or 90, probably through the 30s. Is that how you perceive it in retrospect?
True, yes.
All right.
I mean, you can date it exactly. It was a great reform in 1867. Till then, the University of Vienna was nothing. Now, 1867 it begins to grow. In the end of the century, it reached a high point. It had its highest level in the 1890s and up to 1914. It revived once more after the war, through the 20s, and almost with the beginning of the 30s, it dies, not only in economics, also.
Now, do you just, you don't have to, maybe you don't have an immediate answer, but as a feeling in retrospect, perspective, do you think that the Austrian perspective could have or would have been likely to have flourished and to have come into existence anywhere else except Vienna?
I wouldn't have excluded in England, which happens to be the only other country which I know as intimately as I know Vienna, although there are very specific obstacles. But in general, I found more understanding among English people as almost anywhere else. Sorts. There's a large number of books which have appeared about Vienna. Not one of them is any good, in my feeling. And I mean, I'm not a historian, I will never write a historical book. Although, for your information, I have found biographer with whom I'm not, the Stanford philosopher William Bartley, has all the material for my intellectual biography, who will now even be helping me on my current work.
He's at Stanford?
And in addition, since he is there, Bartley, William Bartley III, Stanford also gets all my papers. So it will all be there. And they're making efforts to get, they have now got some Machlup papers, will not be particularly interesting. They will get other Austrian papers. So after my death, Stanford will be the center where the material should be to study this development. That's, of course, closely connected with the social atmosphere, of one aspect of which I spoke before in connection with the Jewish problem, which is one aspect on it. Well, of course, the extent to which you could grow up in a purely academic atmosphere. My grandfather was a zoologist, my father a botanist, my two brothers professors of anatomy and biological chemistry. My children who grew up in separation from the family as a result of the war. My eldest is an insect specialist, and my youngest boy a bacteriologist. So the bacteriology, and I am in my training, a biology man, training, in my own education, a biologist. It was a great political turmoil at the end of World War I, which drew me into political problems. But even then, while I was studying officially economics, or I should say no, officially law, I divided that time about equally between economics and physiological psychology, and was practical problems relating to insightful economics rather than these problems on physiological psychology on which I ultimately published a book, The Sense of the Order, which is much more important for my thinking than the economists generally understood. Because in connection with the formation of the human perception, that my conception not only of order in general, but the relation of orders of different degrees of magnitude became fully developed. I believe I understand economics because I understand not what's commonly called psychology and sort of psychology, which Freud and so on, have nothing to do at all. And to see how a man is capable to interpret an extremely complex order in which he lives by forming within himself a sort of replica of this order.
The one economist that I can think of, and not a very good one, who recognizes this is a man named Ben Seligman. Ben Seligman. S-E-L-I-G-M-A-N. He wrote an extended critique of you 20 years ago, almost all of it devoted to the sensory order. Yeah, I'll send you a note on that.
Please do.
And it was curious to me at the time, but in later years, I've understood that I don't like his critique, but he's at the right place.
I should still like to see it. The name is familiar to me, but this thing I certainly haven't seen.
I'll remember to send it to you. Now, but what I'm trying to get at, you lived in this unique period of time in this remarkable city. And it was not just you. I mean, it was Freud. It was Wittgenstein. It was the underground, the occult underground as well. Hitler really flourished out of it.
Intellectually, the dominating figure, either by reaction or by adaptation, was Ernst Mach, the physicist. That was the principle of thinking in which we all go. And at first all adopted it. But some of, in my psychological thinking, begins directly with Ernst Mach. Ernst Mach, in his famous book, The Analysis of Sensations, explains or assumes that while all our individual sensation have an original pure quality, they are constantly modified by experience. There's only an original order, and then the experimental chain. Which led me to the conclusion, if you can show that experience can change the thing, why need there be an original quality? The original quality may have arisen in the same fashion. So it's only a step beyond Mach, which turns against him in the result that my own psychology developed. In this sense, I began from the same thing on which the whole logical positivists, Schlick, Neurath, Carnap, and so on, developed from Vienna, but on a split at the base, metres apart very much. But these two, apparently absolutely contrary trends, come from a common initial viewpoint
in Mach.
Well, now, to what extent was there a feeling of free thought in Vienna, freedom? Now, if could you make a comparison to the freedom and the flourishing of the music through Vienna, of Mozart, of Beethoven, and Wagner, and all of these people, and then the freedom? Is there any comparison?
There was a feeling of freedom at the university. I think the decisive point was simply that you were not expected to confine yourself to your own subject. I must have spent as much time in lectures on other fields with other people as I did with economics. In spite of the joke is that nominally I was studying law. It's still, what can I say, it left me time. I took time. I spent my day at the university from morning to evening, but shifting from subject to subject. I would as readily hear lectures about art history or ancient Greek plays as I would hear lectures. Curiously enough, they're mere gaps, in fact. It so happened that psychology had died out by natural death during the wartime. There had been, during the war, still two eminent psychologists who had died. There was still one dying, painfully still giving daily lectures. But you could see this has been a brilliant man for whom now the effort to get through. But he was sufficiently interesting for me to attract me. And it was to us, if we make also a very small elite of the students, it all happened at a time when the university was overflooded by veterans who were coming from the war. The number of students was probably 3 times the normal, of whom 9/10 wanted to get the degree as rapidly as possible. Yet, some of us managed, in an equally short period, not only to get, and I got a first-class degree in law, but to study half a dozen other subjects. The university was welcomed this. There was never any test, either whether you attended the lectures, whether you ought to attend, or whether you attended any number of lectures where you had no right at all. I was going around all through the university, testing out people. I would try people like the famous Kammerer, you probably remember the name of the Custer wrote a book about the he's one man who believed he could prove the inheritance of acquired characteristics and became temporarily famous. But there were some very original figures. All that at the university there were outside what you could call the professional staff. All these private centers were just licensed to lecture, with their own ideas to present, who didn't take an organized scheme at all, but who came in an effort to persuade the students of their ideas. So the variety we had in the 1920s at the University of Vienna was unlimited.
It sounds very much like the University of Berlin in Marx's day.
It may well be.
The same coffee house atmosphere,
oh, yes.
The brilliant young men coming in of all persuasions. And, of course, in their case, I guess Hegel being the overriding influence, the name Mach was in
it
your day.
Probably was like that. But, the contrast, another subject, between the University of Vienna as I knew it in the present is such that I avoid going to Vienna. In every other respect, Vienna is beautifully revived. It's nicer, better built, economically prosperous. But I remember they were desperately poor, but there was this great intellectual excitement about it. And the main people who taught were absolutely first-class people. Every lecturer, nearly everyone was intelligent and perhaps what contributed knew they had to be good in order to have any students. If somebody was bad, he wouldn't have any.
I have never heard of a university since medieval times where that was true. You mean to say that the lectures actually counted for something? That students really went to lectures because they were good lectures?
Well, they knew they would be examined by the lecturers.
No, but I'm thinking of people like you who went here and there and everywhere. Was that common? You didn't have to do it for an examination.
Well, there was a small group of us who did it. Very small group. But I was by no means alone. I had friends with whom I could talk, who would have tried something else, who would tell me it's worth going to this man and worth going to this man, because they experimented in the same manner in which I did. But that was a handful of people.
Let me get back to Mark's original question, though. Is there a relationship between what was going on in Vienna, the city of Vienna, and the openness, if it was openness, I gather that it must have been, and what was going on in the university, which sounds like another equally important experiment in the sharing of ideas?
No. The university was a world for itself. There were at the university, at least in the law faculty, was a very violent political discussion between organized socialists and communists. In fact, even I, although I've never since belonged to a political party, was with one of my friends organizing a German Democratic Association in order to have a middle group between the Catholics on the one side and the socialists and communists on the other side.
And when was this? What year was this?
Well, I was like June 1918 to 21.
Now, I would like to ask a question.
Yes,
go ahead.
I didn't finish for her. But in spite of this, I did complete my law studies in a year short of the official time because I had veterans credits. So for that, I was allowed to in a shorter period. And I managed to do it. In spite of some complication, I came back from war with a fairly severe attack of malaria, so I was not in the best possible health. But having to spend every other evening at home with a high temperature, Didn't much interfere with this.
Now, when were you in the war? What was the time period?
I joined up in the beginning of 1917, went out to Italy in October 1917, and spent exactly a year, just a few days over, a year on the Italian front.
I want to ask a couple of things. One is, you triggered my memory, saying Mises did not respond to your 1937 article as though it was a critique of him. Now, I heard him say a very curious thing once, and I can't remember where it was, but I think it was probably over 20 years ago. He said Hayek's greatest book is The Counter-Revolution of Science. He may have said it to you, but it was public. He did say this. And yet the Counter-Revolution of Science is simply a development of the 37...
The other way around.
Well...
The 37 Counter-Revolution of Science is a book form.
Yes. It's a development of the original perception that you had.
Yeah.
Yet he must have looked at that book. He said
so. He said that.
Do you think he never saw it as a threat to his own epistemology?
Well, I've often asked myself. I just don't know.
All right. Fair enough.
Now, I have a question regarding after the war. You saw, at least, the great German inflation.
Oh, yes.
And did Austria participate in that?
We had it before. The Austrian inflation began almost immediately before the war. My first job under Mises in October 1921, I got a monthly salary of 3,000 old kronen a month. In the next month, I had to be paid the 3,000 three times in order to be able to live on it. And by next June, it reached 1 million in a month. So my first 10 months of professional life were in what then was still regarded as an enormous inflation, that the Germans, 2 or 3 years later, got much higher. That time that a currency should depreciate to finally 1 million per unit, well, there no. What was it? 10,000 became the new unit after the reform. But then a very major inflation. And by the time the German inflation came, we knew all about it. And Mises was the only one who taught us the mechanism of it. Mises was the great monetary expert. That time was almost exclusively a monetary expert. His book on socialism was still to come. Only the first essay on the calculation had already appeared. And at one, well, I happen to know privately, but again, please, off the record, but for your information, I knew that Mises had in his drawer all the papers which would have enabled him from moment to moment to take over the finance ministry, which he hoped he would be called for to stabilize the currency. He was never called for it. One of the great disappointments of his life. But he finally, seeing that it was politically impossible, had a considerable hand in the arrangement that the League of Nations Commissioner was sent to Vienna in charge of finance. And how far he has not been advising this League of Nations Commissioner, I don't know. I suspect that also officially he had no hand with it. The ultimate stabilization was done on his advice.
On Mises' advice?
He was the only person in Vienna capable of doing
it. Mark, ask him about the story.
Is a story, perhaps apocryphal, that Mises was asked by the government during this inflation how to stop it. He said, meet me at 12 o'clock at this building. And it turned out at 12 midnight they met him at the printing, where they were printing the money. And then they said, well, how can we stop this inflation? He said, you hear that noise? Turn it off.
Very nice. It sounds like a story told by Mrs. Simpson. Totally plausible.
Yeah. But what was the relationship of the credit installed? Were they the inflation machine, central bank, or?
Oh, yeah, it's a central bank. Both these central banks financed the government.
Sure.
The government from the beginning was short of revenue, and from the end of the war, financed the expenditure by printing money. And the essential point was to stop this gap in the budget. That was done by League of Nations loan. But to make sure that the government started inflating again, the League of Nations loan was given on condition that after that the finances should for a number of years be in the hands of a League of Nations commissioner. And I must say, I only suspect, I do not positively know, that in what would have been regarded as a highly anti-patriotic measure, it was Mises who behind the scene said they ought to give the Austrian government money only on condition that the administration was put in the hands of the League of Nations commissioner. And he would have been right that unless it was given to him, it was not in Austria, or for that in Germany. An expert would really, except himself, would really understood it, who could have done it. But as it probably happened, the League of Nations commissioner, on his advice, did the right thing. But that on his advice is my interpretation.
Now,
not a national, as the situation was, he had to keep it confidential and would not be free even to tell me. At that time, I saw him every day as my official head in a different job. The only episode I can remember is that he once pulled off his drawer and said, there are all the papers which enable me tomorrow to start as Minister of Finance.
But they never asked him.
Nothing ever.
Well, now...
one of the reasons, if Mises in the end was a very embittered man, that was one of the episodes which made him so embittered.
I don't think at the end that he was.
Perhaps in the course of years,
he
hadn't met him when he arrived in
America. Oh yes, then. But at the end, I saw him within a year before he died, and the American Economics Association had finally given him that award in 1969, and he was beginning to get younger followers. In fact, he'd had them for quite some time. He began to get his respect about the time he was your age, really. And I didn't notice that he was that embittered. So that was a positive thing, I think, in retrospect. But, I know when he first came, though, he was. There's no doubt about it. I want to ask you... maybe one more question.
Oh, wait a minute.
You got a question.
Well, I needed to know, as far as the map is concerned, is it worth pointing out, is Credit Anstalt still in the same building, or are they, do you recall where they're located? Or can we find that in Vienna?
Yes. It had built a new building adjoining, almost adjoining its original building in 1914. And the main building is since 1918 in the same place. Of course, it was then one of the four great banks. Now it has become the one great bank.
Well, wasn't that the bank that precipitated the depression in Europe?
Was another one before the Bodenkredit Anstalt failed first, but they were so closely tied. That when I was already in London when the Bodenkredit Anstalt failed, and I was just expecting the Credit Anstalt to come next by that stage.
And did it?
Again, on the basis of Mises' prediction, Mises had no doubt that the banks were all in a state of quasi-bankruptcy. May I tell you another episode? 30 years later, about a country, must have been in the middle 60s, I was asked by the then right-hand side Chancellor of Austria, after he'd vainly asked Lachnow whether I would be willing to take over the presidency of the National Bank, which I assented on one condition. If I can engage one of the great international accounting firms to check all the nationalized industries, that was the end of the conversation.
I can well imagine that would have been an unpopular decision. When you studied as a young man, I gathered you were at some point influenced by Rickert and the South Baden School.
I was that.
Heinrich Rickert and Windelband. You didn't.
Not I personally. He had great influence on Olaf. He was one of the familiar figures.
Now, and you wrote the introduction to that book by
Rickert.
When
it finally was translated.
Years
it
was later.
Very bad conscience. I'd forgotten nearly all about it by the time.
I'm curious about that because. I see you as a man in the intellectual tradition of Kant and the Kantian movement, especially through the Windelband approach. It sounds the same to me. The whole concept of understanding and historical understanding. Mises also said that he was. The language indicates that he was. And yet the two of you disagreed on epistemology. That's the thing that has baffled me. You're both Kantians in perspective, yet you call him a utilitarian. How would you distinguish the two traditions?
Well, it's again a complex story. You know the book by John Gray about me?
I read it a month ago.
Of course, he interprets me as a Kantian.
Yes.
And I first was inclined to say you exaggerate the influence. I've never studied carefully. But the fact is that at the crucial age of, say, 20 or 21, got very fascinated by the works of a Kantian contemporary named Alois Riehl, who wrote a great work on criticism and two semi-popular introductions. And I suppose what I know about technical philosophy comes largely from a Kantian. So I afterwards took, first I told Gray, no, I know far too little of Kant directly to justify this. And then I had to admit indirectly I got a good deal.
But you are clearly not a utilitarian.
Huh?
You are not a utilitarian in your perspective.
Certainly not now. To begin with, I think it was Mises who made me familiar with utilitarianism. And in my early stages, I'd studied very much. In fact, so much so, I discovered in studying the papers of Jeremy Bentham at University College, that Bentham had been a very good economist, who had done very noticeable work on monetary theory.
Sure, currency, that's right.
And I had started already the highly urgent work of organizing the Bentham papers, which were an awful mess. That broke down. And the first Bentham committee at University College, which I had started, broke up during the war. And the definite start on an edition was only done after me, and after I'd been left London. If I'd still been in London, I'd no doubt the University College would ask me to come in again to assume the thing. But I had by then gone to America, to a wholly different group. I had nothing to do with the great Bentham edition, and I had since become fairly skeptical, because I had become so very much aware that Bentham had been influenced much more by the French 18th century tradition than by the English, or I should say Scottish.
The Scottish rations.
I had discovered the Scots and found that the real root of my ideas lie with Smith and Ferguson and these people. And there was a very distinct conflict between that tradition and the Benjamite tradition. And then, of course, I did these many years of work on John Stuart Mill, which shook my admiration, what I thought a great figure, very much indeed. Because my present opinion of John Stuart Mill is a very critical one indeed.
The influence of Mises' socialism thesis, the economic calculation thesis, it moved you, did it not? Rupke was moved. I gather Robbins was moved. There may have been others. That essay, or at least the book, was really a turning point.
Oh, it was absolutely a turning point. Although I now see it as much less original as I then thought. It struck me as something completely new. Mm. The then dominating opinion. And I don't think Mises knew his predecessor. It was even on this point completely original. I've since discovered, for instance, that the forgotten predecessor of national utility, the German H. H. Gossen, ended up, this proves that without private property and calculation in prices, a market economy is impossible. It's all there, but none of us knew it.
Gossen's book had been pulled out of circulation by him, had it not?
Yeah.
By his publisher.
He died a few years. Well, that's a little suspective story. He did issue a new edition. But when I was asked to bring out the reprint of this, I discovered the so-called new edition was the original with a new title page pasted stuck on it. So there really was never a second printing, but only a second issuing of the old edition with a new title page.
How, when that article hit you as a young man and your contemporaries, it really turned everything, your whole way of thinking.
Right.
Why do you think it is that even today, textbooks generally, if it even gives a footnote to the article, it is only indirectly when they quote Lange. Now, this is 65 years later. It impressed you tremendously. It changed the lives of some of the great minds of our time, and yet it still does not seem to have registered in the minds of men. You alluded before it was partially the utilitarian aspect, but it...
Well,
I don't think it was just that.
Well, they figure Lange answered. And
yeah, but that's because they didn't read Lange.
In the framework of Mises' utilitarian approach, it doesn't quite fit in.
But that didn't. Now, that doesn't apply to your three essays in later.
I was completely convinced. Have you, by the way, seen my latest effort about 2 years ago in the Journal of the London Institute, or 3 pages of fiction?
No.
Where I make fun of Lange. Just analyze Lange and show that every single paragraph is nonsense.
But every single paragraph is still taken seriously in the academic institutions, at least by the older tenured men.
I suppose so, yes. I also have published this in a more widely circulated organ. I gave it that moment to Ralph Harris, the London Institute, to publish in his journal. nothing which I incidentally did, but I don't think that even the believers in Langer can resist that Langer was a fraud.
The Volcker Foundation. What was your relationship to the Volcker Foundation? Because it was a very quiet and very important organization that got no publicity deliberately, but was influential.
Does the name Luno mean anything? Yeah,
Luno, Harold Luno,
yes.
Who ran it? Yes.
Who started it?
Yes. Now he did he
stopped it?
Well, yeah, but that was because Volcker had put in a self-destruct clause in the organization. So
yeah.
There was legality for that, for having.
Luno was the head of the firm called Luno.
It was well. It, yeah, that
hey,
well,
I think it was a son-in-law.
Yes, or nephew. I think right. Nephew.
Something like that.
Now, did they finance your coming to Chicago, or was there some connection?
I wasn't told at the time. But I think John Neff, who organized it, knew that Luno was favorably inclined. And so far as I know, got help from there. But went all through the University of Chicago. From the again, it's a very long story if I start this. When in 1945, 6 months after The Road to Serfdom had been published, I was asked by the University of Chicago Press to come to the States for a lecture tour, and I then was told to four universities for a series of academic lectures that traveled the United States with short films, carefully written up four lectures to lead to four universities. I had no idea what I was in for. Because when I arrived in the United States, while I had been in convoy on the high seas, the situation had completely changed by the Reader's Digest publishing the condensation of my book, which only incidentally, the University of Chicago Press had given the Reader's Digest an advertisement. I never got a penny from this, but that's only incidental.
Sounds like
anyhow, I arrived in New York. The original plan is off. You have suddenly become famous. You go on a lecture tour of the United States. I can't do that. I have never done any public lecturing. Well, that's all arranged. You must try and do it. When do you begin? Oh, you are late already.
Oh, my.
That was a Saturday afternoon. You start tomorrow morning at Town Hall, New York. Meant nothing to me. Mentioning this, revived in my picture, there's beautiful cartoons of some women of women's clubs. Forget what her name was. So I thought, Saturday, Sunday morning can only be such a women's club. So only when I was picked up at the Regency Hotel and taken downtown, I began to inquire from my chairman who picked me up, what sort of audience do you expect? The whole 3,000, but there's no of them. My God, I've never done such a thing. What I'm supposed to lecture on? Well, we have called it the rule of law in international affairs. My God, I've never thought about it. I can't do this. But things are now, they're waiting for me. Yeah. So I was ushered in this enormous hall with all kinds of apparatus, which was strange to me. That time they had dictating machines. There were better as a dictating machine. Microphones, completely new to me, all hands. And my last recollection is, they asked the chairman, 3/4 of an hour? Oh no, it must be exactly an hour. You are on the radio. And so I got up on a subject which I had no idea, and I still know that it began with a sentence. Ladies and gentlemen, I suppose you will all agree when I say, you didn't know yet what I was going to say. And then I discovered And American audiences are grateful audiences. You can watch in their faces with interest. Completely different from, say, an English audience. And gradually, I worked them up into great excitement, and I got through this lecture with great success. I, who had never literally given a popular lecture, never a lecture with a manuscript, suddenly found I was capable of popular lecturing of this kind. And on this principle, I went all over, not all over the United States, as far as the mountains, back south, for 5 weeks, and gradually thought I'd become quite great lectures. On one of these, and the whole reason why I tell the story, one of these, and probably the most significant of these lectures, was to the Economic Club in Detroit. I had my headquarters then at the Quadrangle Club of the University of Chicago, since it was still the University of Chicago, plus it was behind it, or the whole thing, incidentally, was in the hands of the National Concerts and Artists Organization. But that lecture was quite successful. And next morning, or the day after, back in Chicago, a certain gentleman turned up at my club and said, "Professor, I'm not going to take long of your time, but a book like the Ode to Serfdom ought to be written for the United States. Can you do it?" "No, I know no mother." "Can it be done?" "Well, I suppose if you choose a suitable man, it could be done." "How much would it cost?" "Well, I am not familiar with American prices now. I suppose for $10,000 a year, for $3,000 a year, you could be done." "None is yours." But that was Mr. Luno. And I didn't take him frightfully seriously, because I had some long discussions about this with Henry Simons, who had become my great friend in Chicago. And there were some complications. But I finally had to return to England, had to report Luna in the course of the journey. I couldn't have done anything about it. "Cable back. Will you come back for a term to do it?" "Not in your pay. If you arrange for a university to invite me to come as a visiting professor, I might incidentally look after this." "Which universities would you prefer?" "How by cable, you know." Well, I said Chicago, where I started talking with Henry Simons. And then I mentioned, from no other grounds, and I'd never been to the West Coast yet, I mentioned Stanford with certain possibilities. Within 3 weeks, I had the invitations from the chancellor of the 3 universities to go I really persuaded Henry Simon to take the post on condition that Aaron Director, who was then working in Washington, came to join him and work with him.
Now, where would this have been? At Stanford or Chicago?
That was Chicago.
Director was the brother-in-law of Friedman.
Milton Friedman. But he was in Chicago, had taken a wartime job in Washington, and was in Washington at the time, while Henry Simons was the one with whom I negotiated. Now, the thing broke off with first Aaron refusing to take this job, helping Henry Simon, and to my wife on some information, excuse me. But then the curious event happened that as I had moved on to Stanford to make further efforts there, Henry Simons died, or I believe killed himself. In fact, he died quite suddenly. The official story, and possibly true story, is that he was sleepless, the habit of taking sleeping pills. And one night he woke up too frequent, took his often, and didn't wake up. Anyhow, as a result of this, our own director felt, now I feel the obligation to continue what I wasn't willing to do in the Simons. He's a friend. So Aaron Director went from this Focomania to Chicago with the official mission to write a road to serfdom for the United States, which he never did. This is merely the story of my beginning with Luna. I had after this no further direct contact with him except attending some of the discussion meetings which he called. But I have reason to suspect that when a little later John Neff began to make attempt to persuade, what was the name of the president of
Chicago?
Chicago.
Hutchins.
Persuaded Hutchins to call me to Chicago, where it was incidentally an episode. Somebody proposed me first to the Faculty of Economics, and they turned me down.
Is that true?
That's actually astounding. Turned me down. Friedman will not miss a full story. He only naturally assures me that he was in favor and indicates that the opposition was among others. But whoever was behind it was insistent and shifted his efforts from the Faculty of Economics to the Committee on Social Thought, which to me was much more attractive, because after teaching 20 years economic theory, I was a little tired. And the invitation from the Committee on Social Thought was most attractive in the form. You can lecture on any borderline subject in the social sciences. Leave it any time you don't want to teach, you need neither. This with a correspondingly higher salary was irresistible, so I did go to Chicago, and I may well, as you suggest, on the whole time be paid out of money which came from Luna, but I knew nothing about it. To me it came from Hutchins. Hutchins probably had an offer from Luna, and I did later attend many of these focus seminars, and finally all the extraordinary meeting in somewhere south of San Francisco, between San Francisco and Sanford. The final meeting, when Luna probably said, after spending 3 days on the future of the Fokker Commission, I'm going to wind it all up. That's how it ended.
Yeah.
And I'm told that he was then already in somewhat unbalanced mental state.
It was our understanding, and I was later hired by them 2 years later. I was there in 63.
Miss Harper?
Yeah, no, after Harper. Harper left in 62.
Oh, yes, but it's a long period between all. Harper had to run it on quite a long period.
That's correct.
Yeah.
The Volcker Fund. But what we were told was simply that Volcker's original instruction were that he was afraid if it went longer than one generation, it would be taken over by people of an opposing ideological perspective. He had seen it happen,
Rockefeller,
you know, years and years before, and he was afraid that the opponents would get the money. And I think it all finally went to Hoover, or most of it. Hoover Institution. I think.
Did you know the Cornwell still?
I'm sorry, the question?
Cornwell.
No, I didn't.
There were two in succession.
Yes.
The one went up to Hawaii and became a big sugar industrialist.
Yes.
And the other is still about.
He's just done a book.
Quite good books. I'm afraid in between, I'm told he rather indulges in alcohol and gets incompetent. But from time to time, I think of him very highly. I like the man.
All right, my final question. You've seen momentous changes in economic theory and practice. You've seen the rise of the welfare state and the strangulation and near bankruptcy of the welfare state. You've seen in Hitler and in wartime conditions the command economy in all of its inefficiency and tyranny. We come now to the final decades of the 20th century, economic and turmoil. The profession seems to be in intellectual turmoil. Where are we? Where, as a elder statesman in the economic profession, where do you think we are and where do you think the profession is headed?
Well, it's too big a question, but there is a sort of standard answer I've been given to this question for quite a long time, which 5 years ago ran about in these terms. You can now deduct 5 years from my time. What I used to say is, if the politicians don't destroy the world in the next 20 years, there's good hope because a new young generation coming up. How much one can hope from this. But that is so much more favorable than ever hoped that I would live to know such a large number of young people actively working on these problems. See, I thought the maximum I could achieve, what I achieved within my own Mont Pelerin society, which was already a great achievement, fully against the stream. But have this large number of young people actively, and such brilliant people among them as my memory for proper names is going wholly wrong. But the greatest, most pleasant surprise, and one of the most intelligent of them all, is that Nigro, who is now in
Seoul. Yes, I agree.
He's
a
genius.
In my generation, he's the greatest living economist of my generation. No question about it.
But there's a certain Nigro Williams who's the same lines, not of that level. And all the young people, what really sprung ultimately from the Harper Institute, the Institute of Human Affairs, which is now moving to George Mason University, there's a whole group of really good young people. That's very much more than I ever dared to hope.
I wish Mises could have lived to see it. Mark, did you have a question?
Just a couple of things. First of all, why don't you think Friedman and Stiegler and Simons,
Brozen,
the Chicago School.
Knight.
Why were they not, or were they influenced by your being at Chicago? And did they ever look at the implications of your Austrian theory of the business cycle on monetary?
With Simons, I should have a great hope, and his death was a catastrophe. The others are in a methodological line. They are, in effect, macroeconomists and not microeconomists. Stiegler least of all, Friedman very much. And this is a continuous problem. Milton and I agree on almost everything except monetary policy. But it creates an awful problem in the Mont Pelerin society. There's a constant danger to society splitting up into Friedmanite and the Hayek group. And to avoid this, I try to avoid discussions of monetary theory and this kind of thing would bound to come out. Now, in this sense, the whole group who saw this derived from Wesley Clare Mitchell's creation of the Institute of National Economic Research, led by Arthur Burns, another personal friend of mine with whom I do not agree on economics, and they are, in effect, logical positivists, methodological. They believe economic phenomena can explain as macnomena that you can ascertain causal effects from aggregates and averages of further things. But in a sense, in observation is true, though by never a necessary connection. It is quite likely, in fact, I should be preferred to demonstrate historically that every period of inflation ends with a crash. But the historical demonstration is no proof that this must be so. The reason why it happens can now be accounted for by microeconomic analysis and not by a macroeconomic analysis. Now that Milton Friedman thus poo-poos, Stigler, yes, you can discuss it with him, he will see the problem. The other, probably the most gifted man in the Chicago school is Becker.
Very good.
And he is theoretically also a more sophisticated thinker. But Friedman has his magnificent expository power. He is on most things, general market problem sound. I want him on my side. I want nothing less than that the whole Friedman group, with the majority of Americans, would leave the Mont Pelerin Society. But, you know, I ought to add, I have often publicly said that one of the things I most regret is not having returned to a criticism of Keynes' treatise. But it's as much true of not having criticized Milton's positive economics, which in a way is quite as dangerous a book.
The difference would be Milton, unlike Keynes, would never change his mind and would fight you forever had you ever done it. Keynes might have changed his mind.
You're perfectly right. Look, I've written a few essays on Keynes. You may have seen some of them. It was sometimes comic how far he would allow himself to lead into considering things which had so far not existed in his thinking. For instance, that as a result of an overaccumulation of capital, there should be a fall of the rate of interest and the fall in the demand for capital. The whole conception of overinvestment was strange to him, but it was interesting with him. But when you suddenly suggested that there's no direct connection between final demand and investment, it's just stupidity. He would not look at this.
Well, there have been some that Keynes's general theory was written purposely to confuse and to be complex. Do you think that's true, or do you think Keynes was
not as cash as this? But I believe I quoted the sentence already in my last conversation from him.
Yes.
When he actually said to me, this theory was frightfully important during the Depression. If it ever should be wrong, trust me, I'm going to change theory. For him, he was so convinced that he was cleverer than all the other people that he thought his instinct told him what ought to be done, and he would invent a theory to convince people to do it. That was really his approach. I mean, he was very untrained as an economist in economic history. You know, he had a passion for Elizabethan years, for the 16th century, was a great expert. But on the economic history of the 19th century, he was grossly ignorant because he disliked it on aesthetic reason. The 19th century is ugly.
Why did he hate it so much? Why did he hate the 19th century so much?
Well, because he he believed Turner and Company on their history of labor. The impoverishment of the working class.
All right.
It's all dark. Dickens.
Now, I have two other questions to just kind of pick up on everything we've covered. It appears that everyone, you, Mises, Schumpeter, and so forth, left Vienna. You said you were the first one to leave. Others left a few years later. So in terms of personal places, the houses you lived in, so forth, are there any that stand out as a place where we could stop by and look and say, this was Hayek's house when he lived in Vienna?
I think I can point out that this is approximately where Mises lived. That's the only long period. You see, while I lived in Vienna 30 years, I was first...
You were born in Vienna?
I was born in Vienna, but my father earned his living as a medical officer of health, doctor. All his interest was in botany, and finally ended up as professor of botany. But it meant that he was an officer in Vienna and was shifted around. So I grew up in four different apartments, and then for the past 5 years I was still there married, was again another place, so I have no locality. Most of the other people in Vienna would have lived in apartments, not in houses. And in that period, I believe I can show you where Mengel lived for a very long time, and where Mises lived. I knew very well the place Wieser lived, but that was the most delightful place, on the outskirts, up on the hills, but not a place who could in any sense become a social center, while the Mises apartment and Menger apartment were, in a sense, social centers up to a point. If I can point out to you.
What's the other question, Mark?
Apart from university, Chamber of Commerce, the coffee houses, and these two apartments, I don't believe there are any locations worth mentioning. Let me just point out these two. His son was still a boy of 16. So the widow applied to the professors for advice what best to do with the library, which then, in the middle of the inflation, was very much a problem of raising money. And I was invited to inspect this marvelous library. Menger's library was one of the 5 or 6 greatest personal libraries in economics. And they had an offer from Japan. And the only task I really had was to answer the question, was this price adequate, and was there a chance of getting an equal price in Europe? And they had to tell her the price was fully adequate and there was no chance of getting an equal price in Europe. It was the result of my information as the library went to Japan, which I very much regret, but there was no alternative.
The only other question I had was the use of the word von, as in von Mises, von Hayek, and so forth.
It's curious that you should ask the question, but I can refer you to a note which I wrote for this. This is particularly difficult to read, but I hope you can read it to get the full answer here.
One thing that I remember a story, and I only have the vaguest recollection of it, was how Mises got his title, which as a Jew was rare. And it had something to do with his father's getting the title and inheriting it down. But
yeah,
what were the details?
And first the gentleman and the Mises story. The general story is, imagine that in England, all the higher civil servants, than professional men and commercial people who get this for special merit, the title Sir, can inherit it to all their children, and male and unmarried females. Then you have exactly the same position. Instead of being called Sir, you're called Son, usually derived from several generations. The complication arises only that this title was formally abolished and even prohibited at the revolution of 1918. This is a result that in Austria, slightly comically, nobody can legally use himself, but everyone uses another person, and that is not illegal. You're only prohibited to call yourself from. And in Austria, but as a politeness, you still address anybody who is historically entitled. The complication becomes even greater in my own personal case. I was a law-abiding citizen and stopped completely using the title from. But it was, of course, inevitably on my birth certificate. And you're naturalized in England, and for that purpose submitted the birth certificate. When I received the certificate of naturalization, my English came suddenly from Hayek. Now, it was at the moment when I was very anxious to go on an English passport on a holiday to Europe. So instead of invoking bureaucracy to change this, I put up with it. And ever since, lived officially in Austria, I'm legally Mr. Hayek. But in England, I'm officially Mr. von Hayek.
And what about Mises and his father?
Well, Mises and his father, the generally known story is, I mean, the documented story, he said it was one of Mises' ancestors, and that it was for the merits of his father, who was an engineer and builder of railways, and many of the great railways in northwestern Austria were designed by Mises' father. The story, which I believe is true, is that this engineer Mises' father was the son of a rabbi. And when he was offered the title, he out of modesty suggested, "No, I'm not worth it. Please give it to my father." So it was really Mises, for the merits of Mises' father, that Mises' grandfather is supposed to have been given the title.
And is it an inherited title? Does it go father to son?
Yes, yes. Von is always an inheritable title, and unlike the English baronet, the sir, which is all inheritable, inheritable to all descendants, which is true of all continental titles except the very highest. If you are a duke, only the senior son becomes a duke, the other are merely princes. But apart from these highest, I mean baron and so on, they're all inherited, they're all descendants.
Is there anything that you would like to mention or say or comment on now that we're coming to the end? Is there anything now that we're coming to the end of the tape, is there anything else you'd like to mention?
No, I think I've said everything that's worth saying.
We do thank you for the time you've spent. It's been